Now, ladies and gentlemen, here is the latest news of the war, as reported by members of NBC's staff of Americans assigned abroad. For a report from Germany, we take you now to Alex Dreyer.
Hello, NBC. This is Alex Dreyer in Berlin. The attacks against the president continue today, not only from the German press and radio, but also from government officials. The attacks are based on the president's speech, which the Germans say is full of falsehoods. Branded everything from a political criminal to a lunatic yesterday, they still find time today to abuse the president. There's no doubt that never before have the German spokesmen, press and radio, used such venomous language against the president. There's no indication when the attacks will cease. Reports from the east this afternoon reveal that the Luftwaffe, headed by the dive bombing Stukas, are pounding the Soviet positions in and around the Moscow area hour after hour. The high command states that Moscow was bombed yesterday and last night. The raids are said to have been the heaviest yet carried out against the Soviet capital. Large fires are reported to have broken out in whole areas of the city. The Stukas are said to have heavily bombed Soviet rear lines of communication in the Moscow front and to have directed numerous attacks against troop concentrations, field positions, and tank units. 220 trucks, 12 tanks, and a number of artillery batteries are said to have been destroyed. The Stukas also are credited with breaking up 7 railway lines and to have severely damaged 29 trains and 8 locomotives. 7 railway stations are claimed to have been completely destroyed. The high command specially communicated this afternoon that after 10 days of fierce fighting, German infantry units, ably backed up by the Luftwaffe, forced to break through the Soviet defense positions along the slim 3-mile-wide bridge to the Crimea, that little chunk of land which juts out into the Black Sea. The communique asserts that the retreating enemy is being pursued. The high command states that the fighting was hard. The communique asserts that from the 18th to the 28th of October, 15,700 Russians were made prisoner, and that 13 tanks, 109 cannon, and numerous quantities of other war materials were booted or destroyed. And in the north, the Germans are reported to have again shelled the encircled city of Leningrad with their heaviest artillery units. Direct hits are said to have been scored on industrial objectives. Despite the heavy snows and rain prevailing up and down virtually the entire Eastern Front, reports here persist in maintaining that German advances are still being made, and the panzer units are said to be still meeting the most unusual kinds of Soviet defense methods. One report here claims that in one sector of the front, German tanks ran into a dog pack. Each dog is said to have carried a bag loaded with high explosives on his back. The dogs are said to have been trained to leap on the German tanks, the contact with the tank setting off the explosive charges. In the Donetsk Basin, German troops and their allies are reported to be continuing the pursuit of the beaten enemy. The high command this afternoon credits Romanian troops with the capture of an island off the northwest coast of the Sea of Azov. The Romanians are said to be mopping up the splintered Soviet units. In the battle against England, the high command reports that after 6 days of continuous attacks against a British convoy en route to England from Gibraltar, German U-boats sent 14 merchantmen totaling 47,000 tons to the bottom. The merchantmen are said to have been heavily loaded. An escorting British destroyer is also said to have been torpedoed and sunk. The high command asserts that the greater part of the convoy was destroyed, with only a few small ships managing to escape the U-boats. German bombers are reported to have attacked harbor works and supply centers along the British southwest coast last night. The RAF is said to have carried out so-called nuisance attacks last night in central and western Germany. The high command concludes that from the 22nd to the 28th of October, the RAF lost a total of 48 planes, while during the same period, the Luftwaffe is said to have lost only 7 planes. This is Alex Dreyer in Berlin, now returning you to NBC in New York.
Now, just before we go abroad again, here's what the NBC newsroom in New York learns from Russia. The Russians say that Moscow is safe. They've quit worrying about the capital, according to the latest word from Kuibyshev. It's admitted the Germans have opened a new front at Volokolamsk. That's a cotton mill town 72 miles away and midway between Mozhaisk and Kalinin. And new fierce fighting also has broken out around Orel, 200 miles to the south. But the Reds say they're holding and counterattacking everywhere in steady raids. The attackers are said to have lost 60% of their effective strength in the last few days. Repeated German air attacks are failing to hit Moscow's defenses. Russian artillery is pounding the Nazi forward wall to a pulp. And one dispatch this morning states flatly for the first time that the Germans will not take Moscow. And now a first-hand account of events in England. Go ahead, London.
This is John McVane in London. Last night, British four-engine bombers attacked objectives in south and southwest Germany. The docks at Cherbourg were also bombed. American-built Havoc fighter bombers attacked aerodromes in northern France, and one aerodrome near Abbeville was bombed three times in the space of 2 hours. Mr. Hugh Dalton, the Minister of Economic Warfare, in an interview published in the London Star, today declared that the British blockade is making it difficult for the Germans to replace and maintain their plants. He said that signs exist that German industry and production is being slowed down. The minister explained that, as in the last war, the blockade has had little apparent effect on the German forces in the field. But he emphasized that the Reichstag investigation into the reasons for Germany losing the last war stressed the consequences of the blockade. He said Germany's gains so far in the Ukraine aren't products in which Germany is especially short. But he admitted that if the Germans could get the Caucasus oil, that would be another story. Mr. Dalton referred to the facts that the Germans have called in one blanket out of every three issued to German troops in Norway, and that they've requisitioned all civilian ski boots in Germany as evidence that the German army has had to make hurried readjustments for an unexpected winter campaign in Russia. Well-informed quarters in London say that the Germans are also requisitioning blankets from occupied France. It's pointed out here that the German army has now in use about 800,000 horses. These will have to be protected against the Russian winter. And it seems probable that many of the blankets taken from Norway and France may be used for horses in Russia. You get some funny contrasts in a nation at war. In any country, the next man who passes you on the street may be a hero or a racketeer, but in wartime, the difference is more evident than in peace. Britishers today saw that contrast made. One Englishman, for instance, has just been sentenced to spend 3 months at hard labor in prison. He sold 150,000 eggs at above the maximum price. 15 hotels that bought the eggs on his black market have had to pay about $5,500 in fines. Another Britisher, an Australian private, has just been awarded the Victoria Cross, the highest British honor for gallantry. In Syria, a fortified machine gun post held up his detachment. The private, James Gordon, crept forward alone over an area swept by machine gun and mortar fire. He charged the machine gun from the front and killed the four enemy machine gunners with the bayonet. His action demoralized the enemy, and his company was able to move forward and take the position. The third Britisher is a Baptist minister, the Reverend William Smage. He holds services in shelters. When a bomb demolished a post office in his area, several people were trapped in the blazing ruins. Paraffin fumes made rescue attempts look like suicide. The minister volunteered to go down into the blaze at the end of a rope to see if any people remained alive. As he swung down into the inferno, firemen played a hose on him to keep the flames at bay. When they hauled him up, the minister had been overcome by the fumes, but he was able to confirm that nobody remained alive down in the blaze. The king has just awarded Mr. Smage the George Medal. A British Admiralty spokesman, Admiral Blake, today admitted that a navy can't land troops or supplies to assist a land army without fighter command of the air over the landing areas. That's quite an admission for an admiral to make. The admiral was talking about the Russian fleet's work in the South Russian campaign. He said the whole land warfare in South Russia would have had a different aspect if the Russians hadn't had absolute control of the sea and sea communications. Russian sea forces, he said, consist of one battleship, three cruisers, two light cruisers, 21 new and 6 old destroyers, and about 50 motor torpedo boats and 50 submarines. Sebastopol is the only naval base where ships of the Russian fleet can be repaired, and it can't be taken easily by the Germans. But the Russian vessels can refuel and get ordinary refitting facilities at Novorossiysk and Batum. Answering questions about America, the admiral said the greater part of the British vessels now in American ports were there for an ordinary periodical refit and overhaul. He praised the value of American help in allowing Britain these facilities. The latest political rumor going around is that Lord Beaverbrook is going to resign his job as Minister of Supply. Beaverbrook is, with Mr. Churchill and Mr. Bevan, one of the strong men of the cabinet. But usually well-informed quarters are talking about the fact that since his return from Moscow, he's been suffering greatly from asthma. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
And that's the latest news of the war. Next, to hear what's going on in the United States Capitol, here is Earl Godwin speaking to us from the NBC Newsroom in Washington.
Good morning, folks. You know, there's more interest here in this labor crisis or showdown or whatever you want to call it, which this morning includes the threat of a general CIO strike in New York, Connecticut, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, than in almost anything else except the continued strain of that Japanese situation, which is no better than it was 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks ago. In fact, there seems to be increasing danger of explosions right now than ever before. You know, the loud and oft-used cries of the senators debating the administration's foreign policies in the Senate have diminished in drawing power. The galleries up there are filled, but there's no stampede to get in the Capitol or long lines of curious sightseers to listen. Even with Senator Pepper of Florida boosting an American expeditionary force of 10 million, which is much larger army than anybody in the War Department could handle or want or transport, does not produce much more than a mild hand clap from one side and a very faint protest or hiss from the other. But there's a stiffened attitude over the showdown to come. I mean the coal mine showdown. Meantime, the administration seems to be staving off such harsh labor measures as that of Senator Bailey of North Carolina, who would put labor leaders in jail for 10 years if they engineered a strike against a defense activity. There is actual talk of support for the proposal of Congressman Vinson, the Georgia Democrat who was chairman of the Naval Affairs Committee, and his amendment, which has been lost by the House once or twice, would impose a month for cooling off period in any strike before a strike would be legal. And it would also freeze an industry or a factory at the present labor status. That's an open or shut union shop, open shop or union shop during the duration of the emergency. Labor has consistently opposed that, but it is brought up again this morning for discussion. No doubt the coal mines now in the limelight will be operated soon, but under whose auspices and by what law is a question, a confusing question. The president reminded us yesterday afternoon that recently the government has acted to take over two plants or end the strike therein. One of these was that aviation plant way out west where the Army stood guard to permit returning workers to return unmolested. The other was at Kearny, New Jersey shipyard where there was a union row and the Navy has taken that over, as I understand it, without having yet settled the row. Today, John Lewis, United Mine Worker head, is scheduled to see Myron Taylor, who seems to represent a part of the steel industry at least. The United States Steel owns mines which employ 3/5 of the 53,000 striking miners, and other steel companies own the remaining 2/5. There is the same trouble, but two different sorts of negotiations between or among the two groups of owners, and Taylor may not speak for all of them. Northwest Coast welders have been on strike for a considerable period and being urged to go back by the OPM here. Their leader, in effect, says, "Nuts to you, Opie. You've let us down twice. We don't go back to work unless Franklin Roosevelt signs the agreement this time." And that's all from Washington at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Godwin. Now, with this report by Earl Godwin in Washington, we conclude this morning's on-the-spot roundup of news, both here and abroad, which included reports from Alex Dreyer in Berlin and John McVane in London. Keep tuned to this station for the latest news. This is the National Broadcasting Company.